on the Empire podcast this week, we cry "Save Me!" and Lenny James and Nick Murphy hear our cries and appear in the pod booth to talk about their new Sky TV show, which is nice. All that and more on the movie podcast that considers Phlebas. And you think I'm incapable of cultural references. Hello, pod. I'm Chris Hewitt and welcome to the Empire podcast. And I have no idea what that reference actually was because I haven't read that book. But thank you, Helen and Dan, for suggesting that line. It's okay. Very good. Well done. Thank you very much indeed. And welcome to the Empire podcast. And I've given it away already who the two colleagues of such lethal cunning are this week. They are our geek queen. Now we're in 301 podcasts. Another batch of 300 to come after last week's live episode. Returning triumphant, Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm still on a high from last week's live episode.
It was fun, wasn't it?
It was very good fun, yeah. The great audience. Thank you all for coming. It would have been a bit weird talking to an empty room.
Kind of what we're doing now.
Well, no, but this is different. It's a smaller room. You know, it'd be a bit awkward sitting in a giant empty concert hall talking to ourselves.
It would have been embarrassing,
yeah.
I have to be honest. But luckily it didn't transpire. It was a very, very good night. And we're also joined this week by our banana-loving Planet of the Apes fiend, making his first appearance on the podcast for quite a while, Dan Jolin, isn't that right?
I was here when you weren't one time.
That was the last time.
You weren't
really
here. So it's a long time since I've been here looking at your face.
I'm sorry about that.
But no, it was only a few weeks ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, yeah.
A few weeks, really? Yeah. But, you know, I like being, you know, temporary, itinerant. What's the right word? Slack.
Slacker.
Slack, yes.
Slacker. Slacker. Yes, yeah. Slacker is the term.
Oh, well, peripatetic is quite a good one. I like peripatetic.
Easy for you to say.
Yeah.
I mean, not that easy.
Yeah.
What was it last week? Interregnum?
Interregnum.
And now peripatetic.
You know, peri.
Have you swallowed a dictionary, Helen?
I've been trying to teach myself how to do the New York Times crossword. And I discovered yesterday that the absolute bastards can put more than one letter in a box.
What?
Genuinely, sometimes they do what's called a rebus crossword, and there'll be like a particular two or three or four letter sequence that can go in one box multiple times through the crossword to make it make sense. Because there were all these cases where I'm like, I think I know the answer here, but it doesn't fit. I haven't got enough letters. This crossword is broken. There are like lines missing or something. There must be. It doesn't make any sense. And I looked on Twitter and I found some, just did a search for New York Times crossword, and I found somebody earlier that day saying, it's a rebus one. You have to put P.O. in a bunch of the boxes. Spoiler. Yeah, absolute bastards.
Did that make you cross?
I had a word. Yeah. Anyway, I know everybody else on the planet probably already knew that, but I didn't, so I've learned something today. So.
I didn't.
Yesterday.
I'll give you a crossword.
We kind of already did that joke.
Yeah, you were just now.
You were here.
Yeah.
Twats.
That's a crossword. Yes, 16 down. Yeah, I remember.
69 down. That's my favorite. I'm terrible at crosswords. I sometimes sit and watch you fill in the crosswords in anything, in awe. I even struggle with the crossword at the back of Empire, and I'm given the answers to that. I'm terrible at them. I can't think of words.
I think it is a thing about teaching yourselves to do them. Like Kat Brown, formerly of this parish, has been teaching herself how to do cryptic crosswords, which still mystify me. Oh. So, yeah, she's very good at them.
I prefer Scrabble. You make your own crossword.
I'm very bad at Scrabble. Weirdly. Mm. Can't do it.
Really?
Yeah.
It's frustrating. Very frustrating. Because you've got these words in your head.
And they don't fit. You haven't got
the
letter.
And you're looking at the letters and you're just going, what? Poo?
Classic. I bet you do put down poo.
Oh, wait a minute. Pool. Brilliant. One more score. One more point.
Yeah. I'm pretty good at Scrabble. Pretty good. Yeah.
That's okay.
Sometimes I can get over 70 points.
Wow.
Gosh.
Yeah. Wow.
70 points.
Okay. Mm. Excellent.
Don't like the blank tiles. So.
Yes. It's great that this is obviously what everyone comes to the Empire podcast for, is for us to talk about crosswords and board games.
I'll give you a crossword.
You've used that line.
Yeah, honestly.
Brian, should we have a question? Shall we have a question?
Yeah, I think we need one.
All right. So here's a question. The question came this week because this week was President's Day in the US. Obviously, I mean, we don't really have a president here, do we? We have a prime minister. So in the US, I mean, one were to get political for a second, you would say that they don't have a president at the moment, but I'm not going to, because I'm a better person.
See, their president's powers were originally modelled on the powers of the king, So he's closer to, that's why they're obviously also head of state. So originally he was meant to be, he was meant to be a closer analogue to the king than the prime minister. Fun fact.
Can you tell me the name of the first president?
George Washington.
You only know that because of Hamilton.
I don't.
You only know that because of Hamilton.
I don't.
Yes, you do, Helen. Yes, you do. So here's a question. It pertains to President's Day and it comes from at YXLLOP.
Is that a bot?
Xylop? Yixalop? Yixalop? Xylop?
Xylop, maybe?
No, but it's the Y before the X.
Oh, okay.
So Ixalop, or I'm looking at the backwards, Polxy. It's not even a name.
It's a handle, though. I mean, you're allowed to be weird with a handle, aren't you?
Their question was, quite simply, best movie president. And then Helen pointed out that we've done that. I mean, we've been going now 6 years. I imagine we've answered most questions at least once. But Helen said, we've done best movie president. I'm sure we have. So you suggested, and I don't know why this popped into your head, best bad presidents.
Yes, worst presidents.
Yeah, worst or most evil movie presidents. Take it away.
President Evil.
Was there a President Evil, I wonder?
There should have been. Well, actually, it's a recent one, but Bruce Greenwood in Kingsman Golden Circle, he was quite a good one. Because he was just like, let all the drug addicts die. That was kind of, so it was almost like there was a warped logic to what he was doing. So his evil actually came from somewhere where I could actually believe a politician or a president coming to the conclusion that he did, which was like, hey, you know, just fine. It's a problem. Gone, you know, no more drug war because of it or something, which obviously was warped and everything. So that was actually quite good. That was quite a smart thing.
I have, in fiction, enjoyed presidents who were nitwits. Was it President Dale in Mars Attacks, the Jack Nicholson character?
Yes.
One of the Jack Nicholson characters.
Yes.
And President, I've had to look this up, but President Hathaway in Monsters vs. Aliens, who was voiced by Stephen Colbert, who should be president if there were any justice in the world. And both of whom dealt extremely badly with alien invasion.
Yeah, he has a great moment, doesn't he? He goes, why can't we all just get along? And then he has a quite memorable death scene as well, doesn't he? Where he becomes the thing in which the Martians plant their flag.
Yeah,
which is quite fun. He's a nincompoop. But is he bad? Is he evil?
Well, he's bad in the sense of keeping his country, nay, planet, safe. So bad in the ineffectual sense.
Well, then President Thomas Whitmore is initially bad at that, isn't he? And
he is, you know,
Independence Day.
Yeah.
Until, of course, he remembers that he's a fighter pilot and he's born to be in the skies. And up he
and
gets.
This is the day that we will take back our independence.
Yeah.
I love that speech. So, yeah. It's so cheesy. It's
we did great. A thing yesterday in the office, the website Sporkle. It's a quiz website. And
we
did this thing yesterday where we one of the quizzes on there is, can you name every word in famous movie speeches? And one of them was the Field of Dreams speech, if you build it, they will come, that sort of thing. Another speech was Liam Neeson's in Taken, the Dirty Harry speech, both of which I did alarmingly well at. And then it was the today we celebrate our Independence Day speech. I'm 70%, I'd say. 70%, like little tricky words. Yeah. So he goes, we will not go quietly tonight. We will not, something without a fight.
Give up.
Vanish.
Vanish without a fight. Yeah, fair.
We're going to survive. We're going to live on. Today, we celebrate the 4th of July. That's the speech.
Wow. What a guy.
Inspirational.
Yeah.
Shivers going down my spine.
Inspirational. I visited the set of Independence Day Remorse. Independence Day Requiem. What's it called?
Remorse, I believe.
Yeah, Remorse. What was it called? Resurgence?
Resurgence.
There we go. How many stars did you give that, Dan?
Shut up. Not going there.
None of us have a bad sci-fi review in our closet. So that's all. It's all
I just
good.
Thought it was quite fun. Leave me alone.
Had you temporarily misplaced your sanity that day? It's a terrible, terrible film.
I just was in a really good mood, I guess. I just went to see it and went, yeah, that was good fun, wasn't it? It was a bit stupid, but wait, what the hell?
You got to put yourself in the shoes of Ron and Claudine Eccleley, who are from... Do you ever think about these guys who are from small village outside Leeds? And you have to think, when you go see a film, because we're very privileged, we see these films for free, and sometimes people throw sandwiches at our gaping maws, and we sometimes think, what would Ron and Claudine do? You know, they have to get a bus to go off into the centre of Leeds, go to Elgin.
I feel like this is becoming a hate crime.
go to Odeon, spend £10 and tuppence on going to see film. So you have to think about them.
Sorry. Are you Chris-plaining reviews to me?
You have to think about Ron and Claudine, Dan,
I would like to apologise to the people of Leeds and indeed all surrounding areas that accent might have touched upon.
I'm not sure where they were from, to be honest. They weren't from Leeds originally, okay? So Ron in particular, that was Ron. It wasn't Claudine. Claudine is of French origin. She was born...
Bien sûr.
She was born outside Lyon. She moved to England when she was young. Ron, although they've settled outside Leeds in a small village whose name escapes me right now, he was originally born in Bury. Right. So anyway, you've got to think about them, Dan. That's what I'm saying. You've got to think of Bury.
Did you know that St. Edmund is actually buried in Bury St. Edmund's?
Holy crap.
Honestly, I'm learning so much today. This is amazing.
Like, none of it for me.
Yeah, Chris is teaching me how I should review films, and Helen's teaching me useful stuff.
This is good. This is good. All right.
Off the top.
So I was on set of Independence Day Remorse, and in... Oh, I can't even remember where it was. Anyway, so I was there in America, Santa Fe, and they had a soiree in the evening. So we went on set. There was a big press announcement where Roland Emmerich and his cast came out and took responsibility for what was about to happen. And they were playing Independence Day on the big screen, but silently. They had a big screen set up in the middle of this courtyard, and everyone was milling around. And then that speech came on. Mm-hmm. There was a point to this. And then that speech came on, and they turned up the volume, and everybody stood to attention, whether you were, you know, American, British, of alien origin, whatever it was, you stood up and you paid attention to that speech. Goddamn right, and there wasn't a moment like that in Independence Day Remorse, and that is why you have failed, Dan, as a person and as a film critic.
All right. I can take that.
Any other movie presidents who are bad? I'm going to teach you something really quickly. There is a President Evil.
Oh, there is.
I remember seeing this at Comic-Con a few years ago. It is a comic in which Barack Obama and Michelle Obama fight evil. So he's not evil.
It doesn't work,
but he fights evil. But it's called President Evil.
I vaguely remember that poster, actually, yeah. The other bad one that just came to mind is, of course, Billy Bob Thornton in Love, Actually.
Martin Sheen in The West Wing, well evil. I mean, I thought they got rid of him in the dead zone, but then he got through and he became the president.
Excuse me, Dan. In this room, we show respect and love for President Bartlett. That is an inflexible...
But Christopher Walken saw what he was going to do.
I've got one.
Yeah.
I've got a bad president. And this is, of course, President Alan Richmond, played by Gene Hackman in Clint Eastwood's Absolute Power.
Ooh.
Why is he bad?
It corrupts absolutely, that's why.
It does. It really does. And because he's basically...
big murderer, isn't he? Is he a murderer?
He is certainly responsible, maybe not directly, but for the death of his mistress. Mm. And then he covers it up and has it covered up and all sorts of stuff. And
I've got one. There's one, Anthony Hopkins. He played a really bad president. He is President Nixon. You remember President Nixon? But what? I can't remember what the film's called.
No, Nixon, a film about Nixon.
Yeah. It's something where Anthony Hopkins plays President Nixon, who everyone knows was bad. He was a crook.
It's called...
If it'll come back to me at some point, I'm sorry.
I think it was called The Bus That Couldn't Slow Down.
Billy and the Clonosaurus.
There's an evil vice president, of course, in Iron Man 3.
Oh, yeah. This is true. But President Matthew Ellis...
He's a good egg.
He's a good egg. And let's hope he re-ups for a second term. because someone of real metal is going to have to be in the White House to deal with the fallout of Thanos.
Given we're talking about Iron Man, are you talking about a man of real metal with a TLE or with a TAL? I think we need to be clear.
If you were doing a crossword, it would be M-E-T-T-L-E. if it was me doing a crossword, I would cram M-E-T-A-L into a clue that doesn't fit it.
Okay.
There's that actually one more letter in...
I know.
Okay.
I know, I would do it. I would absolutely try and make it fit into a five-letter clue. This is why I'm terrible at crosswords. And there's one other one, Dave. Dave.
What film was he in?
Dave.
I think it was called The Bus That Couldn't Slow Down.
Dave, of course, was Dave in the film Dave. Mm. But the president that he impersonates is Bill Mitchell.
Bill Mitchell, yes. And we know he's a bad president because he didn't fancy Sigourney Weaver.
No way.
Seriously.
It's very rare we have a proper evil president. So get on with Hollywood. Maybe look around. I don't know if you might not find much in the way of inspiration from real life, but you know, just see if you can get on that. All right. So if you want to have your question read out on the Empire Podcast, do send them in via Twitter. We're at Empire Magazine. Use the hashtag Empire Podcast. You can email us as well, podcast@empireonline.com. And you can Facebook us as well, where we are.
Empire Magazine.
All right. So that's that sorted. Let's talk about some movie news now. What the hell is happening? You're right.
I don't know what's happening.
Helen, what's been happening in movie news?
The culture. The culture is the thing you referenced unknowingly at the beginning. It is a series of books by Ian M. Banks, who is a fantastic science fiction author. Not to be confused with the same person when he goes by Ian Banks, who's a fantastic fiction author. But his culture novels under Ian M. Banks are absolutely mind-blowingly fantastic. They theorise a sort of intergalactic, pan-galactic civilization of more or less human beings who do whatever the hell they want because they live in a society ruled over by gigantic machine minds called minds. And they have essentially unlimited power, unlimited resources. They can do whatever they want. They frequently do. People change sex. People live for centuries. People travel wherever they want. People devote themselves entirely to playing games or climbing mountains or doing whatever. And then they just have time to, you know, go about and consider existence, I suppose, basically. But there's so much wit and invention and surprise in these books that they have become extraordinarily beloved by many of us, including myself and Dan in particular, in this room. The good news is that the first of the culture novels, Consider Phlebas, has been opted by Amazon. They're going to adapt it as a TV show. Mm-hmm. And this is pretty exciting news. Now, we were just saying before we started, I'm not sure I would have chosen this novel in particular, which takes place several hundred years before most of the culture stories. You can read them in any old order you want. For a lot of people, the way in is either use of weapons or the player of games, which are not the first one. Consider Phlebas, I didn't love first time I read it, but I really, really liked it when I went back and read it again. And it is set during a very rare occurrence, which is the culture at war. And it's kind of almost a founding myth of the culture. This is when the culture becomes the culture, the dominant force in the galaxy. And so it's a little bit different in feel and tone as a result because it is at war. But the idea is that basically we start with a sort of rogue enemy agent.
Yeah.
Who's a shapeshifter. He's an operative of the Edirans, who are the enemy force to the culture. And he is sent to retrieve a culture mind, so one of these incredibly powerful machine minds, which could kind of change the course of the war if he can get it. So that's his mission. It doesn't go to plan. Spoiler.
Yeah. I think it's... I don't agree that it's not the best place to start, because I actually think it's got great potential for, like, visually, for a drama series. I think there's a lot of action in it. It's effectively, you know, it's just almost a criticism of the book that it's actually just a string of set pieces. So, you know, the plot-wise, it's quite loose and kind of Horsa goes from crazy adventure to crazy adventure on his journey to get to this lost mind. But also there's some interesting stuff happening in it, which is in a weird way, I think, more relevant now than it was when Banks wrote it, because the culture is pretty much modern America to the nth degree in a lot of ways, I think. In the sense, you know, it's a kind of, it's a playground for everyone there. It's you know, it's arguably arguably decadent. And the Edirans are religious. Mm-hmm. They are religious. I mean, you could argue extremists, but for them, this is a holy war. They are fighting almost for the soul of the galaxy. They think that, you know, because the culture is decadent, because it's shallow, that they are going to save the galaxy by defeating them. And they see the culture as evil. And quite a lot of the story is told from the Edirans side. Yeah. By the way, they're kind of giant three-legged aliens.
They're kind of lizardy things.
Although our
hero is humanoid because he's a shapeshifter.
Yes, yeah. But he's a secret agent for them.
You are listening to the Culture special edition of the Empire Podcast. Can we move on to something else now?
Is there anything else worth talking about?
Jesus Christ, please. Please, God, anything else. Should we talk about the astonishing success of Black Panther?
Yay!
At the domestic box office, at the global box office, and you know what? Most of all, in our hearts.
Oh.
It is the true box office champion of our hearts. It did incredibly well, in case you've been living in a rock. living in a rock.
In a rock.
You've been living in a rock for the last week or so, Black Panther.
Maybe it's like an artificially projected rock, and inside the rock is a highly civilized and high-tech civilization
Dan.
Thing.
Oh,
Jesus Christ.
Bringing it back.
Yeah.
You're both banned from the podcast, by the way. So Black Panther did incredibly well. It made over $200 million in its opening weekend, coming second only to the Avengers in terms of Marvel Cinematic Universe. It posted the largest February opening weekend with $202 million, the largest winter season opening weekend, the largest President's Day weekend opening with $242 million, largest Monday in history, beating Star Wars The Force Awakens, the largest Tuesday. This is where the old records get a bit arcane. The largest Tuesday in the history of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And this may be the most obvious record. The highest grossing film called Black Panther. But this is absolutely astonishing that it made almost $500 million in its opening weekend around the world.
It's fantastic. And basically, mathematically, it's almost certain now to end up in the top 10 of all time. And the only question is where it ends up in that top 10, right?
Whether it hits a billion, which would become... We're not going to get too bogged down in box office chicanery. Don't worry about that. But if it hits a billion, that would be really, really interesting, because no Marvel movie that doesn't feature Tony Stark has hit the billion-dollar mark before. And this is really interesting. It feels like almost a game-changer in the build-up to Infinity War. Mm-hmm. You start to think, what's the ceiling now for Infinity War? Can Infinity War go beyond this? Will it go beyond this? Or has Black Panther almost
stolen some of its thunder? Yeah. But, I mean, I think what is also clear is there is absolutely no reason in the world why I shouldn't have Ms. Marvel and Squirrel Girl in my eyes within the next 2 years. Hmm. Okay, maybe three.
Why not? Bring it on. All of it.
All of it.
Can we talk about the culture again?
Yeah,
that was great.
Yeah.
No,
what's your favorite culture book that isn't considered?
Oh no, okay, thing, Helen? No, Dan. What? I will eject you forcibly from the pod booth. You don't frighten me, Joel, and you don't frighten me.
I'd like to see you fucking try, mate.
I've got a crossword for you, pal. But enough box office nonsense.
We have a couple of other big stories.
Yep.
Paul King was in talks last week. I think we talked about him. Possibly tackling a new Willy Wonka. Mm-hmm. And he's also now apparently in talks to direct a live-action version of Pinocchio, mm-hmm. neither of which is Paddington 3, and it's getting a bit worrying. But nevertheless, I'm sure he'll do a wonderful job with this. This is the one that Sam Mendes was on board for a couple of years back, maybe. And apparently the script is currently being rewritten by Jack Thorne. So.
Wow. I'd be careful with Pinocchio, though. A lot of people have been trying to make Pinocchio for a live action Pinocchio for a very long time.
Well, this is Disney's latest live action adaptation of one of its animated classics, and be interested to see what Paul King thinks. I could have asked him when I saw him 45 minutes ago, but I didn't.
Well,
there you go.
Well done, Chris.
Send the Pulitzer my way, if you will. I wasn't even aware that it happened. My God. I had my fingers on the pulse.
There's nothing like research.
Really, and that was nothing like research. In fairness, we weren't talking about the future, we were talking about the past, and I didn't... Anyway, I failed you as a person and as a film critic. But if anyone has the right blend of whimsy and wit and wide-eyed wonder, it's Paul King. And I'd rather see him do this than Willy Wonka.
Fair enough.
And I'm still not sure he should do Paddington 3. Mm. I still think they should leave well alone.
I think if it was a bit, look, if they did it as well as they did Paddington 2, because the more I think about it, Paddington 2 is even better than Paddington. And so I'm now, like, I'm okay with a third. If they have something that they believe in.
Yes,
obviously,
absolutely.
Not just for the sake of it.
Yeah, Paddington just cashes it all in. Big old bucket of cash for old Paddington.
That's, that would not be a good subtitle.
Yeah. Bucket of cash. Paddington kicks the bucket in number 3. Speaking of sequels, Jessica Chastain.
Mm.
Jessica Chastain is in talks to star as Pennywise.
No.
In It Chapter... No?
No.
I got that wrong?
Beverly?
No, it's Chris. We've met before, Helen. You should know.
Sorry.
I see what you mean.
Yeah. I think she might be in talks to play Beverly, who was originally played in the first of the two new modern It's by Sophia Lillis, who's apparently likely to be in the new movie, at least in a couple of sort of flashbacky scenes. And to me, she looks exactly like Amy Adams, and I would go to Amy Adams first. However, Jessica Chastain is obviously a brilliant actress and has form with the director because, of course, she worked mm-hmm. on Mama.
Andy Muschietti is the director, and I think an interview, I'm not sure if this is a new interview, but certainly I saw a quote this week where Jessica Chastain said she loves Andy Muschietti and his sister Barbara, who's also a producer in the film. Barbara's one of her best friends, and so yeah, she definitely has horror history, shall we say. And I think this is pretty much perfect casting, to be honest. I'm not sure if she can play Beverly and Pennywise, though, but
okay, maybe
we'll
just drop the Pennywise then, huh?
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I think it could work, Chris.
Why don't you want me to be happy, Helen?
I mean, it's a long, long history.
How long have we got? Not too long. We've got to cram some more stuff in.
Hey, speaking of things that go on and on for too long, Bond.
Careful now.
Are you talking about culture again?
No, I'm talking about James Bond. So the Bond rumour mill, which traditionally gears up every 3 years and mm-hmm. is insufferable for like 6-8 months before production starts.
It never really stops either.
Well, no, this is true.
It never really stops.
Idris Elba. He's sick of it. Let's give the poor man the role or just let's move on. Anyway.
Too old.
Yes, probably.
Too old. Begin the training.
So Christopher Nolan has confirmed he won't direct Bond 25. I'm not sure who thought he would, but he has confirmed that he won't on Desert Island Discs.
I am not dropping off my chair in surprise.
No. So MGM apparently have a wish list of directors, at the top of which is one Daniel Boyle.
Danny Boyle.
Who has actually directed Bond.
Yes, he has.
Yes, he has. He's directed Daniel Craig.
The Olympics
as Bond.
Opening ceremony.
Yeah.
With Her Madge.
With HRH.
Yeah. And now there's news that would tend to support the whole he's at the top of the list and might be approaching a deal, because John Hodge is apparently working on the script for Bond 25. And, of course, he's worked with Danny Boyle approximately a bajillion times.
Choose Walter. Choose casinos. Choose sleeping with multiple women with absolutely no emotional consequences. Choose flashy opening sequences. Choose a terrible song by Sam Smith. Choose Bond. Very, very quickly, because we have to get into the review section and we have to talk about this behemoth of a magazine. Now, Jurassic World 3 has been confirmed, and Colin Trevorrow is going to co-write the script with a newcomer, Emily Carmichael, who may be part Raptor. I'm not entirely sure. We don't know much about her, but I think she's co-written Pacific Rim 2. So maybe that bodes well for that film.
Indeed.
It's all very, very exciting. So that's going to happen, I think, 2020 or 2021. I don't know. I skim read the story.
Thanks, Chris.
Let's move on to talk very, very quickly about this month's new issue of Empire, because it is all happening, it's all kicking off. Issue 347 of the world's biggest movie magazine is now on sale in all good and evil newsagents, and this one is a bit of a special belter, I have to say. Even more so than usual, because we asked a young up-and-coming director called Stephen Spielberg. Michael Stuhlbarg has taken over Empire. Now, that would be an issue worth reading,
that'd
wouldn't
be
it?
Amazing.
So Steven He's Spielberg, awesome. For It Is He, has taken over Empire, and our features section is largely dedicated to the films of the great man, including, of course, his new movie, Ready Player One. I will race through the content, and if you decide at the end of this that this issue is not worth your hard-earned, then you're dead to me. You know who's going to buy it? Ron and Clementine Eckley.
You've forgotten their names.
We have a big interview with Steven Spielberg himself. There's a shock. I forgot her name. Clementine?
Anyway.
Ready Player One, we have an exclusive look at Ready Player One. We asked a whole bunch of A-list directors to write about their favourite Spielberg movies, including Martin Scorsese and Chris Nolan and Juan Antonio Bayona. And Edgar Wright went one better than all of them, and he got The Great Man on the phone. They talked about Duel, and we'll be publishing that in full on the website. There is a whole bunch of words on a movie called Jaws. I interviewed Tom Hanks and most of the cast of the opening beach sequence of Saving Private Ryan for an oral history of that sequence.
Amazing.
Nick DeSemlian talked to Goldblum, Dern and Neil about Jurassic Park. We have interviews with the Spielberg kids, so the likes of Josh Brolin and Kihei Kwan, people like that, and Dakota Fanning. We also talked to Ava DuVernay about her new movie, A Wrinkle in Time, and Eli Roth about Death Wish and the legacy of Death Wish. And there's all sorts of stuff going on elsewhere inside the issue. Loads of movies reviewed, including Black Panther, Taika Waititi talked to Helen about Thor Ragnarok in the review section.
It was tough.
It was tough. And there's all sorts of stuff. Daisy Ridley says Month's Pint of Milk, and it's very, very funny. And I wrote a sonnet in iambic pentameter for the Inside Number 9 piece.
Did you?
I did indeed.
Are sonnets supposed to be in iambic?
Not all of them, but this one. All right. This one is. So.
Good for you.
I haven't read that yet.
Well done.
It's terrible. Don't read it. Read it. Right. Time now for this week's guests. The new Sky TV show, Save Me, hits on February 28th. You can see all six episodes in one go. I've seen two episodes so far, and it is cracking. It is a thriller set on a South London council estate, and it follows Lenny James Nelly as he is accused of abducting his daughter, whom he hasn't seen in a long, long time. He claims he didn't do it, and he sets out to find the culprit. What marks this out, which is really interesting about this show as well, apart from the fact that it is funny and realistic and moving and gripping, is that it not only stars Lenny James, who of course people might know best as Morgan from The Walking Dead and soon to be Fear the Walking Dead, but he also wrote and created the show as well, all six episodes. So when he came into London this week from a brief hiatus on Walking Dead duties, we dragged him into the pod booth, and alongside him, we got the show's director, Nick Murphy, who directed the likes of The Awakening and Blood on the big screen, but most recently has been directing TV shows like The Secret, The Last Kingdom, and now Liss. Had a lot of fun talking to these guys. They're very, very smart cookies indeed. And we maybe get into football a little bit just towards the end. Enjoy. We're delighted to be joined on the Empire podcast by the writer, creator, star of the new Sky TV show, Save Me. It's one person.
Yeah.
Lenny James.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good, actually. How are you?
I'm not too bad, not too bad. And the director of said TV show, someone I've been trying to get in this podcast for a long, long time, Nick Murphy.
Yeah, I was waiting for somebody else to take over the podcast, and then I'd be happy to come along. you've got me.
How's it going?
Very well, yeah, very well. We're excited. We go out in a week or so. It's, it's just ace for us. Yeah,
February really nice. 28th, all six episodes.
Mm. All six, yeah, being dropped at the same time.
Which is that something that's new to you both?
I did a strip broadcast. I did a show for the BBC about 8 years ago called Occupation, and that was what was called strip broadcast, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday.
Okay.
Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, whatever it was. But the full drop, it's the first for me. Is it for you?
Oh, it's absolutely the first.
Walking Dead goes out serially, does it?
Walking Dead goes out serially. I mean, you know, I've had things like when Line of Duty was bought by Hulu in America, straight to stream, or when something else that I'd made over here that was shown weekly was bought by Netflix, you know, you can stream them straight away. But for us to have made something that goes straight to streaming is new.
You have the thing every Monday where, you know, The Walking Dead, goes out.
I hope it finds such success, Walking Dead. I hope it picks up.
Do you think it might?
Yeah, I'm not sure it's got the legs, to be honest. There's maybe a series or two in there.
Is that why you're jumping ship to a different show?
I am, yeah. It's burning, mate. I'm the first rat off.
But Save Me, I've seen the first two episodes so far, which are fantastic. And this is an incredible story. And can you talk about the genesis of it, where it came from? You play Nelly, who is a man trying to track down his daughter who has been abducted.
Yeah, Nelly's a guy who, I think the way I mostly describe him is the simplest way to describe him, really. He's the geezer at the end of the bar that, you know, 15 years ago, all the men wanted to drink with and all the women wanted to sleep with, but it was 15 years ago. And now it's all a bit tired, but he's still trying to live off of the glory. And he gets arrested and accused of abducting his estranged 13-year-old daughter, who he hasn't seen for 10 years. Mm. And thereafter, the story is about all that Nelly does in order to try and find out who took his child, because whoever took his child took her pretending to be him.
Yes.
And it's about what it does to him, what it does to the people closest to him, and what it does to his community.
And where did the idea come from? Has this been something that's been percolating for a while?
It was bubbling around. It's it was a simple one, really. It was part of another idea I had that I was letting percolate in my head. And then I got a telephone call from my agent saying that Anne Mensah, who's the head of drama, had made a phone call to see whether or not I had anything I fancied pitching to Sky. And so I took a long weekend. I was filming in Detroit. Took a long weekend, thought about it.
And then wrote the whole series?
And then wrote the whole series in one sitting. No, I wrote two pages of the idea and I sent it off to them, and that's what became Save Me.
And when was this?
Oh, do you know what? It must have been 4 years ago.
Okay, wow. And then you set aside a couple of hours to write all six episodes,
yeah.
And everything was good. And
yeah.
And Nick, what point did you become involved?
Well, I got that awful call to be told an actor has written a script. Oh, God. Jeez.
He's not even joking. That's genuine what his first thought
dying,
was.
Dying to read it. It's going to be great. But I was aware he'd written this BAFTA-winning film, whatever, a few years ago. So he could string two words together. And then I read it. And actually, there's a scene at the very beginning, you probably remember, where the people in the local pub on the estate in southeast London, where it's set, contemporary story today, discuss whether or not sharks
yes.
have one or two dicks.
Yes.
And Lenny sort of had me at shark dicks, really, in the nicest possible way. I mean, in the sense, directors look for that sort of something different, anybody that's going to devote 12 pages of an opening first 12 pages of an opening episode to such a conversation, you think is worth sticking with, and it's so at that stage I was on board with, I think, one or maybe two scripts had come out of the writing machine that is Lenny, but it was clearly enough to trust that everything else would come out, and the rest of the surrounding accoutrements of the show were right, the right exec producer, the production company were good, everything felt good.
Yes.
So I was more than willing to climb on board.
Fantastic. And in terms of the working relationship, because Lenny, obviously you're the star, you're the writer, you're the creator as well. Generally speaking, on films, the buck stops with the director. But how does that relationship work when you're working with someone who's written the words, who's saying the words, and has created the show?
Well, it was brilliant. There was never any tension, actually. But I think that came mostly from Lenny. We had an early conversation where there's very complicated. Lenny's scripts are very, very complicated. There's dual dialogue. Anybody's written scripts will know what I mean.
Yeah.
Where the dialogue is presented simultaneously to each other, and you talk over each other. And I said to him very early, I just can't see without hours of rehearsal. I can't see this marrying and hitting the right moments. You're going to have to let me be a bit fluid with it. And Lenny's response was, yeah, okay, let's see. But in actual fact, when you look at the show now, those scenes, they do pan out exactly as written. The rhythms were correct on the page. I'm serious. And that was when I started to realize that then, you know, you realize actually this guy really has thought it through. And I don't allow people to change words on set. I don't like people sitting there saying, can I say lonely instead of isolated or whatever? Because I think a writer's taken a moment to think about whether which is the right word.
Exactly.
the right word. But so even though we didn't change anything, and I tell people at castings that's not going to happen, they're not going to be able to just weigh in. But once on set and once Lenny and I had gained each other's confidence in that way, the augmentation of what was there with the sort of the peripheral bits of drama to do with thanking somebody that passes them a drink and waiting to try and interrupt and just like you have. Yeah. Those sort of things started to leak out of the cast and we knew it was done in a controlled way. So we trusted the process. We knew quite early that we didn't have a cast. We managed to assemble a cast that wouldn't just think, oh, actually I can go weighing in.
And also, sorry to interrupt. Yeah. I think it was, without being too precious about the words on the page, we did say to our cast, because my characters speak with a particular kind of cadence. They speak with a particular kind of rhythm. And I wanted, and it's not always easy, but I wanted the cast to try and say what was on the page. And if it wasn't working, I'm more than willing to change it. But I wanted them to try and get to what was on the page, as opposed to going, that's difficult, I'm going to stick in an or an
or a fuck.
Yeah. Mostly when you ask people to improvise, what they end up doing is swearing loads. And it's not really helpful and it's not really authentic, because someone would mention it if you swear as much as they do. So that was kind of important, and the cast kind of got that and kind of went into it. But as far as me and Nick was kind of concerned, I think there is a tension at the beginning. And I think the good thing between us is that we were both aware of it, you know, because I'd written it and I was in it, and I was, you know, one of the producers of it, there was a kind of sense of, you know, how much am I going to be a possibility of me throwing my weight around? But
yeah.
We had a, actually what happened was is Nick was filming, I think you were filming in Canada.
Yeah,
in Calgary, and I was down in Atlanta doing The Walking Dead, and we kind of met halfway in New York.
For a lot of cocktails.
For a,
a lot of cocktails.
And we had a lot of cocktails. And we went, met at the hotel, we were both staying in the same hotel, and we went to the restaurant downstairs, and we just had a fantastic evening. And ultimately, what it comes down is comes down to trust. Can I trust this guy? Are we going to be open to each other's ideas? Are we going to be able to work together? And over that...
There were times on set that Lenny did say quietly to me, I just wonder if there's a bit more ambivalence in her. He would bring suggestions to me. It's not like I felt he was a hawk on my shoulder, and the producer was absolutely far from that. So I was very free on set, very trusted by the broadcaster, very trusted by the producers. So I never felt threatened. And of course, when you don't feel threatened, you're far more open to stuff than you are when you do feel threatened.
Yeah.
So there were times. It's not like Lenny just mutely said, "Oh gosh, whatever you say, Nick. I'm sure it's fine." You know, he did monitor that in a sense. But also the adherence to the script. It doesn't just matter for the sensibilities of the writer.
Mm.
The process for actors, and all you actors listening out there, the process for actors is part of making it work. Part of the discipline is trying to get that to work. And I made a film a few years ago with Michael Sheen, which I'd written for the BBC about Emperor Nero, and he played Emperor Nero. Mm. And on set, there was some line that was bumping and what I wasn't happy with. And I'd written the damn thing. And I said, Michael, do you want me to, why don't I change it? He goes, no. Our job's to make this work. That's why we're here.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And he was the one that's saying, no. If you give up like that, if you let the worm in your ear and think, actually, if you lose confidence in it, you've got to keep saying, right, I've got to try and find a way of making it work. And in that effort, the awkwardness, and this goes for the staging of scenes. I'm going to deliberately stage this in a challenging way, and we're going to by trying to make this rather awkward staging work.
Yeah,
we're going to find something that's a bit more fresh and interesting than we would if we just went with what was easy.
And the characters are so rigidly drawn. Lenny, I don't know if you can tell, because obviously people who listen to this, I imagine a lot of them will want to get into writing and they want to know about process. And the characters are so diverse and so rigidly drawn in this story. Do you come up with backstories beforehand? How do you go about approaching disparate characters?
For me, it's all about, I don't know whether it's because it comes from myself as an actor. I will have a sense of story, but it's always about the characters that populate it, and it's always about the things that they say. So sometimes I'll write a scene and I'll start off just by writing a conversation. It will just be what I want said in that particular scene. So it's always for me kind of based on the words that people are saying to each other. And then I will, you know, go back and work the scene again and work the scene again and stretch it out and bring in what it should, you know, ideas about what it looks like and where it's situated and where it lands. But it's about the words. So that's where I find it. But, you know, it's got to be pinned around something. So of course I have a sense of, time and place. But on Save Me, it was very much, I wanted to write a thriller. I wanted to see whether or not I could write something within that genre and to be true to the genre and the things that it demands of you, the kind of whodunit, the kind of is he going to find her, isn't he going to find her, what's going to happen, who's that around the corner, who's guilty, who's not guilty, all of those things I wanted to play with. I just wanted to set it in a place where usually people don't tell the story of a thriller. Usually if it's something set on a housing estate in Southeast London, it's all about living on a housing estate in Southeast London, and that's not what I wanted to do. I wanted that to be obviously the kind of to feed into the story but not be the story.
And a lot of thrillers are only about thrillers as well. I mean, you know, when Lenny says to be on the genre, I mean in the way it does, in the way Rear Window does. The Rear Window is as much about Kelly and his relationship as it is what's happening over the over the way, and that's that becomes the architecture of actually the thriller. So what happens is to Save Me, yes, there is a thriller plot running through it, but the ramifications and the ripples on the pond that cause in these very, very visceral, well-realized characters, that becomes the takeaway. That becomes what means you tune in for the next episode. It isn't so much to find out just the big mystery, it's to see that play out in the people you know. So I think, you know, the genre is too much writing nowadays. I watch a load of stuff, and an awful lot of it is just tripping from writer deceit to writer deceit. Now the character's going to say this. They probably wouldn't, but I need them to because I want them to get them to go to the church, and I need them to do this. I need them to. So it's all just bundling, quick, bum, bum, bum. And I think we've got enough thriller plot in ours to fill 3 or 4 episodes of one of these hyper, normal hyper sort of narrative based thrillers. But instead we take our time. We take our time to, in order to properly feel you've got the proper fabric of a world in which the thriller's happening. Thrillers happen in thrillers all the time. So if a child goes missing, or somebody cheats on each other, or somebody's killed, it's not shocking in a cinematic space in that sense. Mm. It's only shocking if you feel it happens in a space that is an environment in which it would be shocking.
Yeah.
And that, I think, you do come away thinking from when you watch Save Me, you think, God, yeah, how would they cope? Bloody hell. And of course, a lot of it's funny. They didn't spend an awful lot of time moping around going, oh, she's missing, I can't believe it. Life goes on. And that's the other thing, the benefit of the scripts. They contain this sort of warmth, because when people go missing, people also get hungry and they also have arguments. And they also misunderstand each other.
And also, I think there's a sense now, because we're all wise to it, and everybody can do the writing courses online. There's a lot of television and films that are about tropes from televisions and films, and not about things that necessarily happen in real life.
Yeah.
And one of the things that was very important to me was that my characters are behaving based on or versions of real life, as opposed to based on or versions of other characters on television. and I think it's really important that we firstly can tell the difference, and secondly that we do something that's kind of different to, because otherwise all television starts looking like all those people who go to the same plastic surgeon and end up looking
I agree and
you know what I mean?
I've
read a lot of scripts. Obviously, I'm lucky enough to read a lot of scripts, and half the time the characters are described that way. So and so, the novice over keen, you know, you're describing them as a sort of cliche in parentheses after you meet each character, rather than actually I'm going to build a set of characters and then apply some set of circumstances to them. So writer tip number one is, don't base it on something else you've seen. It's just, and we didn't with the scenes, did we? We would say, does anybody here feel like this is something from a telly show?
Oh, really?
And we go, yeah, it does a bit. The stopping and the turning and the, okay, mix it up. We just listen out for our antennae. If it just felt like a TV show, let's just make sure it never feels like a TV show. And we made a rule at not 1 minute, not 30 seconds, not 5 seconds should the audience be able to pause it and say, I know what's going to happen next.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
That was a biggie for us.
That's amazing. Was that difficult in the writing process?
No, I think I can't actually recall a moment where we went, I knew that was going to happen. But we weren't necessarily just going, let's bury it and put it down there so that no one will know. It was just that, you know, people might be able to guess, but we just wanted to make sure that we weren't laying it out for them or leaving ourselves open to it, because we're about to go down a road that's, you know, is the easy route to get from A to B or C to D, as opposed to let's try and find the real way there. Mm.
And cliché is nobody's fault. I never blame actors particularly want to do what the right thing.
Yeah.
So if they, and we've talked about this, Lenny and I have talked about this, is the toga syndrome. If you give an actor a line and put him in a toga, he will start to speak like this because he feels this is what is expected when you're a toga. And they want to do what they think a TV show expects them. So if it's a cop scene, they certainly, without any direction at all, start behaving like TV cops. Not like cops, but like TV cops. And that's that because they want to do the right thing. And they need to be encouraged and freed to say, okay, you don't need to. And the producers were always giving freedom to Lenny to say, don't feel you need to, you want to tell the story like we'd make suggestions about what if, but never feel you're telling it because this is what TV shows do.
Excellent.
And that produces a lot of the great feedback we're getting, and the reason the channel love it so much, and going so ape on the publicity of it, and so pride they've got in it, is I think because of that. It doesn't behave like a TV show.
And Lenny, you're just about to head back to America to start filming on, I guess now, Fear the Walking Dead.
Fear the Walking Dead,
Fear the Walking Dead for you. Is that a difficult change to get used to?
Do you know what? It's a strange one, I'm not going to lie to you, because I had all of 6 days between finishing on The Walking Dead and starting on Fear the Walking Dead. And in between that, I had to come back here to do some stuff for Save Me.
Oh,
so it has been a bit of a blur. And I have to keep reminding myself of on which particular part of the zombie apocalypse I'm taking my particular character to. But I am enjoying it. It's a rare opportunity that an actor is given that I've found myself in, where I've been associated with a character for kind of on and off for 8 years. Mm. And if you had said that to me before I left and went to America, I'd be like, oh my God, what have I done? Have I signed up for Coronation Street or something? I'm playing it, this geezer forever and ever and ever and ever.
No disrespect to
Coronation
Street.
No disrespect to Coronation Street or other soaps that I could name. But
other soaps are available.
Other soaps are available. So I had a decision to make when it was first suggested to me about moving over to Fear. But I just looked around and I thought, who else has been offered after you've kind of created this character, taken the responsibility of him? I'm very proud of the work I've done playing him and the place he has in the mythology of this show. And then I'm offered the possibility of taking him to a completely different place with completely different actors and to invest in him and explore him in a very different way. Uh-huh. And I looked around and there wasn't anybody else who I could go, oh, you mean like that person did or like that person did? And figured that was a unique opportunity, and I'd be silly to say no.
Frasier.
There you go.
Pretty much it.
That's but that was it. It's really about it, isn't it.
That was a completely new show. So it was a straight off spin off. I'm a character that's been established going into a show that's been established and taking one to the other. It's a you know, because there are other things like, you know, spin offs from the Mary Tyler Moore show or
Happy Days,
you know,
and whatnot,
or
yeah.
Better Call Saul or you know, things like that. Mm. So there are examples of building a show around it, but to go into an already existing show as a character that's been established on another show, if you can come up with another fella, I'd be really happy because I quite like to speak to that person.
I have one. Richard Belzer, the comedian actor, he holds
Law
the record. Holds the record for playing the same character, John Munch, on about 12 different shows.
Because he did Homicide as well, didn't he?
Started off in Homicide, Life on the Street, then moved to Law & Order, SVU. But as a joke, he keeps showing up in different shows as Munch. So he's been in Arrested Development, he's been in The Simpsons, he's been in The X-Files, he's been in all sorts of stuff as his
this
character.
This is a sort of Burbank in-joke, is it?
Yes.
This is that's hilarious.
He just will show up in the background for two or three
that's
shots.
Fantastic. That's fantastic.
It is great. He started off in a completely unrelated show and then popped up in Law & Order, SVU. But what that means, of course, Lenny, is that then you have to have multiple Morgan spin-offs from this point on. You have to have your own Frasier-type spin-off.
I have to be in The Simpsons.
Please,
put him in The Simpsons. Let's just stop right there and let's deal with that one. I have to be in The Simpsons. Yeah.
And you're happy to stick at that,
do you know what? I'll settle for that. I'm not,
all right,
I'm not greedy. Oh, let's just do The Simpsons.
We'll get the word out, Matt Groening and the team. It will happen. It will absolutely happen. And Nick, what's next for you?
I'm sticking with Sky. They've asked me to develop a... an 8-part series for them, so I'm
fantastic
tapping away, spending my days at the end, my office at the end of the garden, trying to make sense of 40 years of espionage.
Oh wow! So you're writing this one as well?
Yeah,
because the last few projects you've directed.
No, directed, and actually I have to be careful who I admit this to, and I certainly wouldn't say it on a podcast. But I back myself as a director, but I'm quite a good writer. So I need to concentrate extra hard. But I'm working with a journalist called Martin Bright, who's an observer journalist, Spectator, and such. And he's helping me with the factual background to this opus that we're constructing across, as I say, 40 years of espionage in Britain. It's a great. Great idea. We're very happy with it. So that's going to take a lot of my time now.
Fantastic. So obviously the last couple of years for you have been Save Me and The Last Kingdom and The Secret and then the one you're working on now as well. But you have obviously directed films in the past as well. Are you working on anything?
I don't want to go back to... I say this, you know, if DreamWorks rang, you know what I mean? If Barbara Broccoli, if you're listening.
But Simpsons movie,
Simpsons movie starring
Lenny
James character as Morgan. Yeah.
For no reason.
In the bar, propping up the bar. Yeah. There's something when you're ambitious as a young man, you sort of step out, young man or woman, you step out and you just want to eat it up and just go and make movies. And that's what we dreamed of doing. That's what we imagined. You know, we went as kids. They kept me going as a child. So movies have a special place in the heart in the way that TV never quite will. But you have real life to get through. And movies are too commonly constructed on the idea of, okay, we're going to film in September.
And okay, I'm not going to get paid until you shoot it, by the way, until you actually get the cameras out of the box, you're not going to get paid on it. But we're going to start in September, and it's now May, and you invest all this time prepping it, and then something happens, a little glitch in the schedule and availability of the actor, and actually, we're going to push it. We're going to push, and we're probably better to go in February. Actually, March. Tell you what, we're going to go April. And suddenly, you can't build your life around that. And you end up with an independent movie. Yes, you have the opportunity for great authorial control in movies. Mm. Yes, you're taken far more seriously as a director in movies when you're not in television as much. And writers are far more the key holders. Mm. But in truth, that's changing. And I think you end up making a TV show. Now I'm getting to the point where I'm hugely trusted as a director. I'm you know, perhaps wrongly, but I am. And the audiences you get are bigger than you would do in an independent movie. So, yes, I'd go and do the larger movies if the opportunity arose. I was listening to the last podcast talking about Otto's. Well, Otto's a brilliant director, and that was it was great. That's finally happened.
Robin Hood, yeah.
And yes, there's that's always tempting if something like that happens. But the television's a great medium. It's great. It's got it. You have expansive, long stories, big arcs, schedules being invested in where you can, like with Save Me, I can direct all six. Yeah. And so you end up thinking, what with over the duration of the show, it's a 5-hour movie I've made, and that's the opportunity to do that. You just can't find an independent cinema, and I miss it. I love it. I still want to watch movies forever. I still love the idea of us all sitting quietly in the dark together, but it's TV is so good now.
I think if writers, at the moment, if they have an idea, their first port of call is TV and not necessarily movies anymore. And it used to be all movies. Mm. But now if you're having an idea and you're given the option of telling it over 2 hours or telling it over 10, most writers are going, well, let's do that 10 thing.
The writer is all powerful, pretty much. It seems to be from the outside looking in TV. Mm. Someone like Jet Mercurio on Line of Duty would never have the control on a Line of Duty movie, straight off the bat. Anyway. And one last thing before I let you go, Nick. A couple of years ago on The Awakening, you gave special thanks to Fernando Torres because you're like me, you're a big red. Lenny, I believe you're a Spurs fan.
It's only now you're telling me that you also. So for all this time, you decided to keep it quiet.
Oh, yeah.
And never told me that you too.
Because you're close to the exit.
Okay, Mercy.
You could have left at any time.
I could have. If I'd known.
But actually, I am. What you're leading to is who, because every. Oh, I should explain this to Lenny in advance. Is every project I've done on IMDb, I've put a special thanks to somebody associated with Liverpool Football Club.
Really?
Okay, Stevie Gerrard and Jamie Carragher and whatever. And Chris picked it up when the first time he came on set for The Awakening. He'd spotted that I'd thanked Fernando Torres.
This was before the betrayal.
Before the betrayal. But it's okay. We had good years of him. And you're going to say, who am I going to thank on this one? Well, with Lenny's permission, it's hard. IMDb are not letting me change any of the page. And if anybody of the listeners go to IMDb, right. I swear to God, the lead actor on this is a very sweet guy, but he is a doorman. and they won't let me change the order.
It's just alphabetical, right?
Listen, you're 23.
I know. All the effort I put in to be number one.
So if anybody there can figure out a way, if IMDb, if you're listening, for Christ's sake, will you let us change the damn page to running order? And I can also thank you. I can thank a member of the Liverpool staff.
Absolutely, yeah. Please, who would you thank if it came down to it?
I think it'd have to be Mo at the moment. Mo Salah, who's hot on the heels of somebody called Harry Kane or whatever.
Someone, yeah, it's going to be interesting.
Harry takes penalties and he's a centre forward, doesn't quite count.
Well, Mo doesn't. He's so good, Harry. Yeah. If it weren't for the fact he was taking penalties, we wouldn't know his name.
No kidding.
Never would have heard of the fella.
Mo doesn't, exaggerate contact in the way that Mr. Kane might.
Does he not, Mo?
No. Okay. Actually, Dele Alli's worse than in my humble opinion, allegedly worse than Harry. I think Harry, that's a bad example. And
I had a very good view of the penalty incident at Anfield the other week. I was there,
what was he supposed to do? Jump over the arms? Is that what you're saying?
Were
you supposed to do this goalkeeper
even,
a favour?
That didn't even result
in a leg.
Didn't even result in a goal. I think everybody got so animated about that. The penalty was saved, and the second penalty.
The second penalty was a penalty.
I think it was a penalty.
It was a penalty.
I was in the main stand.
You think it's a penalty.
I'd be straight up. If it wasn't a penalty, I'd say we got away with it, but we didn't. It was a penalty.
I felt that we got away with it. I actually saw Virgil van Dijk kick Lamella, and I was like, did anyone else see that? And no, the referee's fine. We're good. And then, the Lions are flagging. You can't do that. It's not the rules. Look it up. Oh, it is.
It's
okay. It is the rules.
Yeah, it's scary. Well, it was a good game, though. It was a very exciting
game. It was a very good game, yeah. It was a very good game. I went from joy to despair in the space of about 2 minutes, which was fantastic for a six-hour journey home.
I think the people of Rochdale went in the reverse in recent games. So.
We cannot talk about FA Cup results.
No. Better be careful.
We can't do that. Yeah. Guys, it's been an absolute pleasure having you in. Thank you so much indeed.
Thank you, Nick.
Cheers.
Okay, so that was Lenny James and Nick Murphy. Helen, you've wrote my sonnet.
Yep.
Thoughts?
I had questions about one of the rhymes. I think it's a half rhyme at best.
Yeah, that's totally fine. I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
Have you seen the episode of Inside Number 9?
I haven't. You see, that's why I'd originally skipped it, because I didn't want any spoilers.
Right, okay. So there's loads of half rhymes in that. They rhyme bum with Magnus Magnusson, for example, at one point. Right, so it's totally... So what's the half
we've
rhyme?
We've all done that, Chris. Come on.
What's the half rhyme?
Pentameter and beater.
Shh.
Okay.
Shh.
I'm just saying.
Pentameter.
Yeah, but that's not what you say.
That's how I say it.
All right.
Right, so let's talk about this week's movie releases. The big one, I would say, is the freshly minted BAFTA winning. We didn't talk about the BAFTAs.
We didn't talk about the BAFTAs.
We didn't talk about the BAFTAs.
Let's do these and then talk about the BAFTAs and try to add it in if we
okay. So, the freshly minted BAFTA winning for Alice and Janney, I, Tonya.
Yes, so she plays Lavona Faye Golden, who is the mother of Tonya Harding, who's first played by McKenna Grace and later Margot Robbie, who is, of course, the skating talent who kind of takes the world by storm, but also by surprise. She comes from a very deprived background. Her mother pushes her and pushes on her behalf as a skater, but does not necessarily push on her behalf as a person, and is... borderline abusive or just full over the border? I mean, you know, you can talk
I'd
about
say
that.
Full over the border.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair. And basically, Tonya becomes a sensation, almost despite herself, certainly despite the opinions of the skating world, who are a little bit horrified by her sort of, I don't know how to say it. She's kind of not even blue collar. They're sort of not quite even that respectable kind of a background, but just unconventional, hard scrabble is probably the word, background, and her completely take no prisoners attitude towards the conventions and the sort of pretensions of the skating world. However, her talent is pretty much undeniable, but she always feels like she's never getting a fair shot. And she is... unlucky and unwise in love as well. She gets married very, very young, essentially to escape her mother, is very much the impression we're given in the film, to a mechanic called Jeff Galuli, who's played by Sebastian Stan, as you have not seen him before. And their relationship is also pretty disastrous. And it's all about the build-up to, of course, some of you will remember the scandal that erupted after her rival was beaten or was attacked. So she was convicted of or pleaded guilty to conspiring to hinder the prosecution of those responsible for the attack. So the feeling was that she was aware at the very least of what was happening or covered up for it afterwards. This film is very sympathetic to her, but not to the extent, I think, of whitewashing a lot of her rougher edges completely. I think there's a little bit of an element of whitewashing, but not completely. But it's just, it's a great character piece, both from Margot Robbie and, of course, from Alison Janney and Sebastian Stan. I mean, he's kind of horrific in this, but in a very realistic, kind of convincing way.
He's the Winter Olympic soldier.
You're so proud of yourself for that, aren't you? So yeah, so I think the film doesn't always get under Harding's skin the way that you want to. I think there's a lot of kind of stylish stuff going on that maybe distracts sometimes from the story. So there's a lot of... The film acknowledges straight up it's based on wildly conflicting accounts from all these people involved. So, you know, there's a question of separating fact from myth, which I'm not sure always necessarily does right. And it has been criticised by people who originally covered Tonya Harding for being too... sympathetic to her, but at the same time there's an element of rebalancing to be done, because she really was monstered, and this film says, well, maybe she didn't entirely deserve that, and maybe she was sinned against as well as sinning. So very surprisingly funny, very, very good drama, and very, very good performances from the cast. We gave it 4 stars.
Yes, we did. I liked this film a lot. I thought it was very, very sippy, very, very cool, made me laugh a lot, but you know what, made me think as well.
Thanks,
not
Chris.
Too much. I was mainly laughing. Performance is very, very good. Alice and Janney, I think you could argue the toss all day about people who we're up against in our category. I think Laurie Metcalf is fantastic, and Lady Bird, I think Holly Hunter should be nominated all day long for The Big Sick, but she is fantastic in a role that it almost seems tailor-made to win Best Supporting Actress Oscars and BAFTAs. She will win the Oscar as well. She is an unrepentant monster in this. And Margot Robbie is fantastic as well, real depth. And I like the fact that it plays fast and loose. There's a poster quote, I can't remember who, which magazine it's from, it's not us, the Goodfellas of figure skating movies, because there's so many of them, so you have to differentiate which one's which. Oh, this is the Goodfellas one. All right, get it now. It very much owes a debt to Martin Scorsese and to Goodfellas,
yeah,
I would say,
so.
Stylistically, directed by Craig Gillespie, and written, Helen, do you know who the name of the writer?
Not off the top of my head.
Well, this is why Sebastian Stan obviously did the piece. It's written by Stephen Rogers.
That's it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He can really do anything, can't he?
Yeah, Bucky just can't get away from Stephen Rogers, can he?
Can't say no. Mm-hmm.
I could do this all day. Yeah. But yeah, I think this is a terrific film, and 4 stars, and is fully deserving.
I look forward to seeing it.
Well, I look forward to watching you seeing it.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I was too busy watching Finding Your Feet.
Me too. I saw that.
Yes, which yeah. If you don't want to go and see the really good I, Tonya, and you fancy going to see something else, then don't go and see Finding Your Feet.
Okay.
Which shall I talk about it?
Let's talk about Finding Your Feet then. Yeah.
So it's very obviously aimed at your kind of baby boomer for the third ages, which is fine. I'm not against films that do that, but there's just something about it that's just not trying hard enough. So Imelda Staunton plays a woman. She's a bit of a
snob,
middle class snob, hyacinth bouquet, or rather bucket kind of character. And it's a big retirement party for her husband, played by John Sessions, who it turns out is having an affair with Josie Lawrence, which is a bit of a whose line is it anyway flashback situation. And spoiler. And
this is the first 5 minutes.
This is the first 5 minutes. So she moves out. She's aghast. Her life has fallen apart just as she thought she was going to settle down for retirement. And so she moves to a sort of inner city London estate where her free loving bohemian sister, played by Celia Imrie, lives. And it's a sort of odd couple fish out of water thing going on for a bit. Mm-hmm. And then it kind of hooks, but doesn't really commit to this, hooks to a kind of a dance classes.
Yep.
Because then it turns out that Staunton's character once could have been a show dancer, but her husband was against it and stuff like that. And she rediscovers herself, and she meets a new man who's played by Tim Spall, who plays this amiable tinkerer kind of a guy. And it would all be sort of, you know, slightly cringingly delightful. But I actually found it had some, like, there was some quite horrible casual racism in it.
Yeah, they never apologise for that either.
No.
And I think, like, at the very least, Celia Imrie's standing there right after and doesn't say anything. And it's clearly... Yeah. Anyway, that annoyed me.
And that wasn't the only instance, because there was a comment later. I don't even want to repeat it, but there's a comment made, there's a joke made about somebody. And I just sat there thinking, 2018 people, you don't make jokes like this anymore. What the hell were they thinking?
There was also, it's got a weird attitude. Like, the film wants to kind of have its cake and eat it in terms of dealing with big issues about death and illness and so on. But it sanitizes them within an inch of their lives. I mean, well, inch of their deaths. I mean, you know, death is so easy and non-traumatic in this film that it's actually far more upsetting than it would be if it were dealt with properly. And the illness stuff is badly handled, I thought. And I thought it was really disappointing. Because it is, you know, I think there should be more films where Imelda Staunton gets to play a lead role, for example. I think she's great, nothing against her, but just the film around her is not worthy of her time.
Mm. I mean, Tim Spall looks a bit embarrassed to be in it. he sort of doesn't look particularly happy in any of his scenes. But I mean, you know. But yeah, it just annoyed me.
Annoyed me.
And it felt like it was almost like the writers or everyone involved thought that because they were sort of they were aiming at a less demanding audience or something, almost like a captive audience.
They won't.
It just felt like they just weren't bothering.
It felt like they were actually bending the story to fit the tropes.
Yeah.
In a way that actually did it a massive disservice.
So then 2 stars for Finding Your Feet, which sadly does not find its feet. I think we should very, very quickly talk about the BAFTAs because we completely forgot to do so in the news section. It seemed to be a fairly predictable set of results this year.
Yeah, I think everybody expected Three Billboards to do well. I mean, there were some people were saying, oh, Shape of Water is likely to win everything because it is the most nominated film, but I don't think that it was, actually. I think it is still a monster movie, and that does not necessarily become front runner at the BAFTAs just because it gets a lot of nominations. It's a fantastic one, but not necessarily front runner. So Three Billboards was both best film and best British film. Outstanding debut went to I Am Not a Witch, which was a fantastic result, I think. Coco for best animated film. Guillermo did pick up best director, which is not to be sniffed at. Screenplay, best adapted went to Call Me By Your Name and original to Three Billboards, so a good spread there. And I think all the acting awards went exactly where we thought they would. Frances McDormand and Gary Oldman in the leads, Alison Janney and Sam Rockwell in supporting. So no surprises there. Yeah, I mean, but great results further down the list. Baby Driver picking up best editing, I think, is highly deserved.
Yep.
Blade Runner, best cinematography. Yep. No one ain't going to argue with that. Yep. That's well, I mean, I know a few people who do, but they shouldn't.
The Deeks. Seems like he's going to break his Oscar duck.
I hope so.
Doesn't he?
And then Dunkirk for best sound, you know, that kind of thing is pretty unarguable.
I just feel that, you know, everyone was very deserving of their wins, but I do wonder if it just needed a bit of an upset. I mean, for example, last year, Dev Patel won Best Supporting Actor over Mahershala Ali, who was winning everything and then obviously went on to win the Oscar. And I do wonder if that might have been the category to spring a surprise. Maybe Hugh Grant for Paddington 2 would have had home advantage. Everyone loves that film and that performance. And maybe it just needed something to really push it home.
The other thing is, I feel like if you have a category called Outstanding British Film, it should maybe be more British. I think it shouldn't just be the producers. I think that shouldn't be the thing that...
It's producers and obviously where the money comes from. It's a film for film. So that,
But do you know what I mean? It feels odd. And
but then
I think
also
if you're going to use... If the BAFTAs is about celebrating British film that maybe other people wouldn't see, you want it to go to a God's Own Country or a Lady Macbeth.
Or which Paddington 2.
Or a Paddington 2. Which maybe haven't had the same attention in the US. And I think, you know, so it would be helpful sometimes to have a bit more of a tighter link on those films, I think, in that category.
For me, it should have been Paddington 2. It's
obviously
the best, that should have been up for more, in my opinion. It's the best film in that category. It's the biggest success in that category. And aren't these awards sometimes about rewarding success as well, in a way? But you would have had the slightly absurd situation, had something else won Best British Film, of Three Billboards then winning Best Film later on. So I can see how it won both.
I think there's a logic in some of the voters' decisions there, but I just think... The other thing I think is, and, you know, BAFTA have all obviously made their decision on this not that long ago. I think they should move back after the Oscars. And I know that they moved into the pre-Oscar season because it gets them a bigger, starrier turnout of the Americans are more likely to come over if it's still in the Oscar race. But there was something to be said for the BAFTAs being post-Oscars and not kind of joining that race and not kind of being part of that push to, you know, try and convince people that they're important to the Oscars. It shouldn't be about that. It should be a different thing. It should be its own thing, the way that the Goyas are, the way that the Césars are. And it really isn't now. It just feels like a satellite award, which I think is a little bit disappointing.
Yeah, I do get that. But I also feel that it wouldn't be as relevant. And I think it needs to be relevant. It needs to be seen as part of the race, the Oscars. As it is right now, it is the last stop along the way. And the fact that they get all these big names, that's a huge win for them. Years ago, I don't think you would have got, I mean, pretty much every major nominee turned up. Even ones who must have gone, like, must have turned up thinking, I'm not going to win this one. I'm not going to win this because Alison Janney's winning everything. I'm not going to win this because Sam Rockwell's winning everything. But here I am, nevertheless, because it's important to be seen. It's important to celebrate. It's important to be part of that celebration. And I actually do think that it's a good place for the BAFTAs to be right now.
I guess so. It was also interesting that the black dresses of the Globes continued into the BAFTAs, which I wasn't sure that they would. And I'm now wondering if it'll continue to the Oscars.
I would say so. It's going to be the biggest platform. What was interesting as well is that an awful lot of guys were wearing Time's Up badges as well.
And also some of the male winners actually mentioned it in their speeches this time, which literally none of them did at the Globes. So I think they've at least picked up a slap on the wrist.
Knuckles.
Slap on the wrist, rap on the knuckles has been noted. Also cool to see Frances McDormand just being honey badger about the whole thing. She and Joel Cohen just sitting there like, I mean, we have no part in what's going on here, but we're just going to sit and get through it.
Yeah. Of course, she didn't turn up in black and then was just like, I can't but help but kick against conformism or something.
Well,
you know,
I just think those
weren't her exact words, but yeah.
But I think someone like her has the great advantage of literally no one would question that she's a feminist. No one with half a brain is going to question that she's a feminist. And equally, literally, no one is going to expect her to be a performative feminist.
Yeah.
So, absolutely. I think it's the people with more to prove who are more concerned with wearing black.
Yeah.
I should mention a couple more releases this week that we're not going to be able to talk about in great detail. So there is Dark River, which is Clive Barnard's follow-up to The Selfish Giant. Not a sequel when I say follow-up, it means it's her next movie. And of course, Ruth Wilson was on last week's live podcast, fantastic guest, along with Taron Egerton. If you haven't listened to that, do listen to it. And it is a gritty drama set in the Yorkshire Moors, and we gave that 3 stars. 3 stars. And then there's Birth of a Dragon, which is a strange kind of not really biopic of Bruce Lee.
Oh, I thought it was going to be about a dragon.
Yeah, not
like
about
someone
a
gets a dragon egg and then it goes in the fire and then it comes out and then they become a queen.
And then they move into a dungeon.
Yeah.
Oh, and then someone rolls a dice. It's a D20, and it all goes wrong. So this is about Bruce Lee and his friendship with a fictional actor, but someone clearly modelled on Steve McQueen in early 1960s America. However, it's a Bruce Lee biopic that doesn't have a whole lot of Bruce Lee in it, focusing instead largely on the actor, which is a strange choice, shall we say. Let's give the filmmakers a benefit of the doubt about the decision. But yes, it's a 2-star film. I reviewed that. I didn't think it was all that. Some decent fight scenes, as you might expect, though. And also, we haven't seen yet Duncan Jones's Mute, which hopefully I'm seeing tonight. It hits Netflix tomorrow. Well, today, Friday, the 23rd?
22nd?
That'll
do.
Whatever it is. Hang on, let me just check.
It's the 23rd.
23rd. It hits Netflix today, Friday the 23rd. Obviously stars Alexander Skarsgård and Paul Rudd and Justin Theroux. And looks fantastic. And early word from the States is very, very good. But we'll find out for ourselves tomorrow on Netflix. And do check the Empire website as well for a review of that. And another science fiction movie, which is getting a limited release this weekend, is a film called Native, starring Rupert Graves. And this is co-written by Neil Atkinson, who is the main host of the Anfield Rap podcast, which is a podcast I love, and he has moonlighted, shall we say, and co-written a film. So it's coming out this weekend. I think you can check it out on video on demand as well as in select cinemas across the country. So Mute and Native, look out for those. And that's it.
Yeah.
That is it for this bumper-packed, culture-packed edition of the Empire Podcast. Helen and Dan are probably going to talk about the culture now for another 20 minutes. I'm just going to leave and let them go to it.
Look, it's really good, Chris. You'd like
it. Yeah, yeah. I mean, Use of Weapons. I mean, just read that. If you only read one, read Use of Weapons.
I've read Ian Banks novels. I've never read Ian M. Banks
novels. He's so much better than Ian Banks.
Yeah, he is.
Yeah. They always look so dense to me, like
they're fun. They're actually fun. He has a real sense of humour.
How would you compare them to, say, the Dan Simmons books, like Olympos and Ilium?
Close. Better.
Less of a head fuck than Ilium and Olympus.
Yeah.
Well, that's not
which, by the way, if anyone's listening, we really, really recommend Dan Simmons' Ilium and Olympus.
Absolutely.
And in fact, almost any Dan Simmons is pretty damn great.
Yeah, yeah. His other non-sci-fi books are really good fun as well, like Drood and
The Terror.
The Terror's fantastic. Now,
Abominable is also great.
I haven't read that yet. Got it on hardback when it first came out and then forgot to read it for some reason.
A lot of people don't like it, but I love it.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah, culture. Oh, yeah. Brilliant.
Culture all the way.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Right. Well, that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun. We'll be joined by Francis Lawrence, director of Red Sparrow. Ooh. And, of course, before that, 87 Hunger Games movies, I Am Legend, and Constantine. So we'll be joined by him, and that's going to be a lot of fun. Until that auspicious occasion, it is goodbye from Dan.
Goodbye.
It is goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
And it's goodbye from me. I am off to hand deliver a copy of the new issue of Empire, of course, which was curated by Steven Spielberg himself, to my good friends Ron and Clemmy Eckerly in their small village outside Leeds. It's a long walk and I might have to take a bus. So,
hate crime.
It's not a hate crime if you absolutely nail the accent of someone who has moved around in their lives and has a bit of an accent, a bit of a patchwork quilt of an accent, wouldn't you say? Wouldn't you say, Ron? Yeah, I would. Eckers like. See? Ron agrees with me. Thanks for listening. Dan's not sure about that. Thanks for listening. See you next week. Bye.